Chris Dudgeon has a lifelong fascination with sharks. Her friends describe her as the sort of woman who loves the things that all the rest of us think are scary. Chris Dudgeon is a shark research scientist, and she was present when something incredibly weird happened last year at an aquarium in North Queensland. A small leopard shark, by the name of Leonie, had had several baby sharks. The thing is, there had been no male shark in her tank for at least 2 years. Leonie had previously had shark babies the normal way, but this time there were no males in sight. There was a flurry of headlines all over the world, which all went along the lines of shark virgin birth, shark makes her own babies. Chris Dudgeon has spent much of her working life on reefs, in shark cages, or just in the water, grabbing, tagging, observing and photographing sharks, which she says are just stunningly beautiful creatures, leopard sharks in particular. And it turns out that not only can some sharks have babies without the menfolk, there are some sharks that can walk as well. My word. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Richard.
We'll get to the walking sharks a bit later. First, tell me about leopard sharks, or zebra sharks as the Americans call them. What do they actually look like?
The leopard shark is quite an unusual species. It doesn't have any very close relatives, and they are part of the bigger grouping of the carpet sharks, and these include things like wobbegongs. And wobbegongs, most people are probably familiar with. They're flat. You see them really on the bottom most of the time. And there are other little sharks as well. But one of the other members of this group is the whale shark, which is the largest fish in the sea, and is similar to the leopard shark because it's a bit yellowy with black spots in the adult form, and they have these big ridges running along the side. But leopard sharks are much smaller. They reach a bit over 2 meters in length, and one of their more unusual features is they have a really long tail, which is almost half of their body length.
Now, leopard sharks, if there was one shark you would say was endearing, it would be the leopard shark. I think it's really very beautiful and quite like you could make stuffed toys with it. That's the kind of fish it is. The spots, do they change their spots as they go through life?
They start out as stripy. So when they hatch out of the egg, they have very bold, dark and light stripes. And so these stripes stay for about the first year of life, and they start to break up into different spotting patterns. By the time they're around 2 years old, they've lost the stripes entirely, and they have different types of spots. And then as they keep growing, those spots sort of migrate around the body. And in the large adults that we see, so for example, off North Stradbroke Island, when they aggregate here every year, we see quite a diversity of spotting patterns. Some of them are just single spots, some of them are almost like rosettes, and in parts of the world we also see some that have no spots at all.
So you say they're what, 2 meters long or thereabouts? Are they bitey when it comes to people?
Not at all. They will only bite if they're really harassed underwater.
And when you're in amongst them and you're doing research on them and you might need to tag them or get a sample from them, how do you get hold of them, Chris?
All sharks seem to demonstrate some sort of tonic immobility, where if you put pressure on their snout, they go into a sort of stationary mode, really. But leopard sharks do something a little bit different, and that is if you grab the very end of the tail, they go into this tonic state, so they go all floppy. We think this is because this is a strategy that the males use for mating. So you can see in some aquaria that where males have gone following a female around, and then he bites the very end of the tail and she goes all floppy, and then he's able to position her for mating.
So you're, if you're in the water and you've got to grab the tail of this leopard shark, so you grab the end of it and it goes floppy, what does that mean? It just sort of droops in the water? What happens?
Well, it depends on where they are. So if they're on the bottom and you grab the end of the tail, they just stay there, really. Mm-hmm. If they're swimming past and you grab the end of the tail, they basically go floppy and just stop swimming.
And then you can do what you like with them to some degree? They're just inert, are they?
Yeah, essentially. So what we're doing for the most part is taking a little bit of tissue off the end of the tail. So this is for genetic analysis, and we use a cattle ear notcher, which is a little bit like a hole punch. And other things that we have been doing using this technique for is to bring them up to the surface so that we can insert acoustic tags for tracking studies.
Now, you go into the water curious about them. Are they curious about you?
I don't think so. They do look at you. I think they're concerned mostly if you're a predator and you're going to cause them problems. But for the most part, they seem to be very placid and will just stay where they are unless you get too close and start to bother them too much.
Where did this come from, Chris? When you were a kid, were you one of those kids that was always out and about in the natural world finding specimens and little animals and that kind of thing?
I was always curious about animals, and I definitely loved having different pets. And particularly, I just always loved beach holidays. I think that's where my fascination started.
And how old were you when you decided you'd be a marine scientist?
Maybe around 14.
What about sharks in particular? What got you curious about them?
Well, around that time, I recall watching a television show, and there was a fisherman being interviewed on this show, who's quite a famous fisherman at the time, Vic Hislop, and he was being asked why he caught and killed large sharks. And his argument went along the lines of that because we fish out so many of the smaller fish and we don't leave enough for the sharks to eat, they start to want to eat humans. And so the way to solve this problem is to then go and kill the sharks.
Right. It's us or them, is it? Is there any evidence to back that theory up?
Not really. There's no evidence to suggest that sharks eat people as a food source. There are certain species that, so namely white sharks, for example, that do eat marine mammals as part of their diet. And so some of the ideas are that it's a case of mistaken identity. Recently, people have been talking about that perhaps it's also more to do with juvenile white sharks that are transitioning. So these, when they're young, they eat fish, and then they, as they get larger, they eat mammals, and so they also have to learn what they can and can't eat. So there may be moments of mistaken identity there.
So you did your degree in marine biology at James Cook University in North Queensland, and then went off to South Africa for a while. What kind of work were you doing there, Chris?
I really wanted to experience sharks in the wild, and I knew that South Africa was one of the best places in the world to see great white sharks, as they had been protected there for a long time, and they have a fair few. And so I signed up as a volunteer on a white shark research program that also took out tourists to do cage diving with great whites in the wild.
I'm assuming it's a sturdy cage, this thing. It's a very robust cage that protects you against all comers.
The cage felt more like it would protect you against chickens rather than white sharks. It didn't quite have the rigidity of the cage in the movie Jaws, but it did its job, yes.
And you discover this when you're in the cage in the water, I'm sure.
Yes.
So tell me what that sensation's like to be in that cage and a great white shark just cruises past. It'd be so big. I wonder if it'd be sort of like, you know, the opening scene of Star Wars with the Imperial cruiser going overhead. Is it something like that?
Perhaps. The first sensation, the cage is right at the surface, so it's tethered to the boat. And when you jump in, you have a hooker line, so there's the air is on the boat and you have a regulator in your mouth. So you don't feel that you're drifting in the ocean or anything like that. But the very first sensation is that the water is so cold, it sort of takes your breath away. And so then having this shark come past, you just forget about all of that. You're just absolutely entranced by this animal. And they're so sleek and they're so perfect in all of their design. And I think the one thing that really, I think, captivates you with great whites in particular is that they are a visual predator. So they have quite good eyesight compared to many shark species, and they do look at you. So you feel that you are being watched rather than the other way around. And it's very humbling, but not scary. They're very calm in their approach.
Calm? Really? What? How can you say that? I don't understand. I'd be terrified, I think. And why weren't you terrified?
Because when a white shark is attacking, they use an element of surprise. They have much better vision than we do in the water. So they can see us, we don't see them. So if they are in your visual sphere and they're coming past you, they're not attacking. They're just having a look at what's going on. And so it really, you just are watching an animal in its environment, swimming around, checking out its environment, and there's no sense of that I'm being hunted or anything like that. It's just a real privilege to get to see this animal.
When they pass close by, is it silent?
Yes, it is. Apart from your bubbles, that's the noisiest thing.
about 15 years ago or so, when I was doing a TV show, it was put to me by some science, anyway, as it was then, I can't remember the source, that sharks are rare creatures because, unlike many other creatures in the animal world, they don't age. This is what I was told. They don't experience senescence. They don't get old and decrepit. They just age, and they eventually die from starvation or the hazards of living in the wild. Is there any truth to that, Chris, to your knowledge?
I'm not sure how true that is. There has been a lot of research into cancer with sharks because it's been thought that sharks don't develop cancer. And so perhaps in that respect, sharks don't die from cancer like a lot of people do. That seems to come with age. However, sharks are not ageless. They do die eventually. And one of the things about shark survival is that most of predation occurs when they're young. So that's really when sharks are the most vulnerable. So when they get large, many of these species, there's not many things that can eat them. And so if there are not sharks living in the oceans that are thousands of years old, I would assume that senescence will occur at some point.
Okay, I'm going to take you further into the realm of the anecdotal and away from the scientific, Chris, I'm afraid. A friend of mine who's got a friend says that they heard a story about a shark in WA that was believed to be 230 years old. Can that possibly be true? Is that nonsense?
Well, it would depend on what sort of shark it is. A recent paper came out that suggested that a Greenland shark, which is a very deep sea, deep cold water shark that is found around the world, but these ones are particularly, they were studying in off the waters of Greenland, that these animals were reaching over 600 years old.
My God. Wow. That's extraordinary. And do you think that's something to do with the cold or the conditions and the location of where the shark likes to swim at the bottom of the ocean?
I would think so. So I think the cold conditions certainly would slow down any aging process. They're essentially being preserved in very cold water compared to things that live in the tropics. There's a range of numbers in the estimates too. So the one point of that estimate that they had very good data for was that during bomb testing in World War II, this releases radiocarbons into the environment that they can pick up in the skeleton of the shark so that they can calibrate how old the shark was at that point in time.
What, like ring barking a tree, you mean, but through the bones of the shark?
Indeed. So essentially, the sharks lay down rings in their skeletons, and that's how we can age them.
You decided to do your PhD on leopard sharks, these beautiful creatures we were just talking about earlier, and this was on Stradbroke Island. What is it about Stradbroke and these sharks?
Well, Stradbroke Island is one of the most beautiful places on Earth,
I am
a little bit biased, but mm-hmm. I do think it's extraordinary. But it's also extraordinary because there is a particular site called locally as the group or Manta Bomi, which is an aggregation site for lots of sharks and rays.
And what brings them there? Why do they aggregate there?
We're not 100% sure about that. So the leopard sharks we see there tend to be resting. So it's possibly the continental shelf is quite close to North Stradbroke Island, and so there aren't that many reef structures around at which animals will be aggregating. So there certainly are cleaning stations where there are cleaner fish that remove parasites off animals, and when we see manta rays there, they tend to be being cleaned by those animals. And we do see the different sharks and rays also being cleaned. So that might be one of the attractions of that site.
And when you're out there studying these sharks, do you get to know them? Like, do you recognise individual sharks and name them?
Yes, we do. So each of these sharks has a unique spotting pattern. And so we can use that pattern to say who's who and track them over time. So some of the animals we've been tracking now for 13, 14 years. And so for the leopard sharks, I've given them different names after people. But for manta rays, for example, if divers contribute photographs to those projects, they get to name them.
Okay, they get a manta ray named after them. How do you track their movements?
A couple of different ways. So one of them is through photography. So people contribute photographs to me, and we can see individuals at different sites. So, for example, these leopard sharks move between North Stradbroke Island and Byron Bay quite regularly, and so we're able to follow those movements. But we also use a type of equipment called acoustic telemetry, and this is a tagging equipment which it has a two-part system. So we deploy an acoustic receiver in the water, and the receiver essentially has an underwater microphone, and it's connected to a battery pack and computer. And that gets deployed and left at the site, and that can pick up an acoustic signal in approximately 500 meter radius around that receiver. And then we put a tag on or surgically inserted into the animal, and that tag lets out a unique code. So whenever that tag is within the receiving range of that receiver, we know that that animal's there.
Where have you got these little these units to receive these signals? I mean, how far up and down the coast are they?
We maintain a couple of units off North Stradbroke Island and also off Lady Elliot Island, but there's actually a national database and a national facility for this equipment now, which is the IMOS Animal Tracking Network, and it's absolutely fantastic. So there are hundreds of receivers deployed all around Australia, and when people upload their data, it goes into this national database, and if your animal is picked up on anybody else's receiver, you get an email that says, Bob was sighted off, you know, Coffs Harbour at 12:15 a.m. on the 2nd of February 2016. And it's just fantastic.
Almost like a holiday postcard, is it?
That's right, yeah.
How far do these leopard sharks roam then, now that you know where they're going?
Much further than we thought originally. We thought they were very sight attached. So we knew that they were off Stradbroke Island in summer and that they weren't there in summer, but we're now picking up movements between Coffs Harbour up to the southern Great Barrier Reef quite regularly. So that's around 1,000 kilometres that they're moving in a year. And we've had one go all the way up to Townsville and back in 6 months, which is much further than we thought they would swim.
Now, this brings us to Leone, the leopard shark, the extraordinary leopard shark from North Queensland. She had been in a tank. She'd been having babies the normal way, if that's how you'd phrase it, with Leo, her male companion, and then they were separated. Why were they separated? Why were they pulled apart?
They were too successful. They had had many babies, and when they're small, they're only about 30 centimetres long, but it's very difficult for aquaria to maintain several 2.5 metre long sharks. So they wanted to stop that breeding program.
And they'd been separated for, what, 2 years or thereabouts? And then Leone started doing something strange. Tell me what followed there, as best you know.
After 2 years, Leone started laying eggs again. And
is that normal? That's normal whether they're pregnant or not?
That's right. So much like a chicken, they'll lay eggs whether they've been fertilised or unfertilised, as long as the conditions are good for it. And so she started laying eggs, which wasn't unusual, but my colleagues at the aquarium started noticing embryos developing in the eggs, and none of which of those survived. Also, Leone had a daughter shark that she made together with Leo, who was just reaching maturity, been placed in the tank with her. And this shark's name is Lolly. And Lolly had just started laying eggs that year too, but her eggs weren't very well developed. So
they were fertilised though?
No.
But Leone's were?
Well, we didn't know whether they were fertilised or not. We just knew that there were embryos in those eggs.
So these eggs had embryos, but none of them hatched. And what happened then?
The following year, Leone started laying eggs again, as did her daughter Lolly. And this time, embryos were observed in both of their eggs, and some of the babies hatched out. So Leone had 3 babies hatch out, and Lolly had 2 babies hatch out. And there were 2 possible reasons why these babies appeared after the male had been removed from the tank. One of the reasons is sperm storage, and that has been shown in sharks for up to 4 years.
Really? Female sharks can store sperm for 4 years?
Yep.
But not in this case?
Well, we didn't know. So the alternative explanation is what's known as parthenogenesis, which is the Greek term for virgin birth. And in that case, the embryos develop without fertilisation.
Had this ever been seen, observed before in a shark, parthenogenesis?
Yes, it had.
Right, so it can happen then. There is a precedent for this. And once they looked at these hatchlings or pups or whatever you call them, or baby sharks, were they quote unquote normal? Were they developing okay? Were they in some way malformed?
No, they look perfectly normal, just behaving and physically similar to what you would expect.
But with children, they share, like I said, 50-50 DNA from the mother and from the father. What was the DNA situation in these children?
So these parthenogenetic offspring had only DNA from the mum. So we took tissue samples from the babies that were developing after the male had been removed, and we also compared it with some of the offspring back when Leone and Leo were mating. Much like us, sharks have XY sex determination and they're diploid, so that means they get half of their DNA from mum and half of it from dad. And also, if they receive a Y chromosome from the dad, they are a male. And if they receive an X chromosome from the dad, they're a female. So the dad is the one that determines whether those babies are male or female. So very similar to how humans are. And so when we looked at the genetic markers of these babies, we could see that the ones that were produced sexually had half of the DNA from mum and half of the DNA from dad, and also we had some males and some females. But when we looked at the ones that were produced after Leo was removed, they had none of his genetic signature at all. So they only showed DNA from the mum, and they were all girls.
How excited were you by this discovery, given that you're someone who'd studied leopard sharks for years and years and years, and here is one having virgin birth? Wow, you must have been pretty interested in that, Chris.
I was absolutely fascinated by this, because we knew that sharks, there had been records of sharks reproducing via this parthenogenesis or asexually before. But what was different about this study and really captivating was the fact that this female switched. She had been producing sexually. She had lots of babies. You know, she'd had a good sexual history of success. And then the male was removed, and then it seems in response to that, she just decided to go solo. And to me, it seemed to be such a quick switch, given that these animals, you know, live for quite some time.
And was there any kind of suggestion that she developed some kind of male sex organ alongside her female sex organs?
Not that was evident.
So do we have any idea how the embryo formed then? Do we know much about the science about that, Chris?
We don't know the actual mechanism, but we can make some inferences based on the genetic signature of the offspring. So as I've mentioned, they didn't have any of the DNA from the dad, but what was unusual about their genetic signature and why we could see this parthenogenesis is that they only had received one copy of each genetic marker from the mum.
So is there any understanding of how this could possibly happen then, without the presence of some kind of male sex organ creating some kind of sperm to fertilise these eggs?
We don't know what the exact mechanism was, but the offspring have a very distinctive DNA signature. And so rather than when a female produces the egg in normal sexual reproduction, a female produces the egg and the male produces the sperm, and they combine to make the complete DNA signature of the offspring. So in this case, rather than the female egg combining with this male sperm, somehow the DNA of the egg has been duplicated.
Oh, okay. So there's a meeting there, but it's between like and like rather than male and female.
That's right. So when the eggs are produced during what's known as gametogenesis, there's also other things called polar bodies that are produced as well, and they have the complementary DNA that you find in the egg. So it's thought that perhaps the egg combines with this polar body, so it's sort of almost self-fertilization rather than a male sperm coming into the picture.
Well, let me just ask another question then. What's the thinking on, you know, in Darwinian terms, how such a thing is possible? Do these things become necessary sometimes when the species needs to reproduce? Is this some kind of, I don't know, emergency measure for a species?
Possibly. So it could be a holding on mechanism during times when a mate is not present. And in particular, because we've seen that this animal can switch between these reproductive strategies, perhaps this is something that these animals can do fairly rapidly when it's required. But it's not likely to be a very good long-term strategy.
No.
these babies are essentially severely inbred. They only have half the genetic diversity of the mum. And so over time, they would need to mix up that gene pool to deal with the fact that, you know, you have all of these much more rapidly mutating things to deal with, like pathogens and environmental conditions as well.
So once they were born and this was announced to the world, how hot did your phone ring after that happened, Chris?
There was a lot of interest, yes. It was picked up very far and wide, which was fantastic, yet a bit surprising.
How are those pups that are named Cleo, Cece and Gemini, how are they doing, these inbred pups?
Cleo is doing really well. She's still thriving up in Townsville. And CC and Gemini were sent to the Melbourne Aquarium, and CC, I believe, didn't make it. A bit of variation there.
And just finally, Chris, you spend a bit of time in the world of walking sharks. Walking sharks? Walking. Is that a recent thing, or have they been doing that for a while now?
I think this is something they've been doing for quite some time. Perhaps you'll feel more comfortable to know that walking sharks are on average about 80 centimetres long. So yeah. These are not sharks that are coming out from the sea onto land in some B-rated movie.
Now, but who knows what the future holds. And how do they walk?
They walk on their fins. So right. they have two sets of fins, base pectoral and pelvic fins, so the ones near the head and the ones further down the body. And so these particular types of sharks, they're also known as epaulette sharks, and they're very cute. I think most people would like them if they saw them. But they have a particular adaptation, which is that they can survive in very, very shallow water with low oxygen content when the tide goes out. And at that time, they become the big predator on the reef. And so when they're in this low water, they can't really swim. So they use that time to walk around on their little fins.
Still, sharks that can walk, sharks that are having babies without men. It's terrifying. It's terrifying. You think there's a huge overreaction to sharks? I mean, yes, they kill people. They do. There's no doubt about that. Do you have any thoughts on the kind of the numbers, of course, are very, very small. You're more likely to have a fridge drop on you, I think, than to be killed by a shark. What do you think accounts for the intensity of feeling towards sharks, Chris?
Well, I think as humans, and it makes sense that we have an innate fear of things that can eat us, and it's probably served us quite well since we're a very successful species. And you see on land, we have put a lot of effort into taming our environment. So we don't have large predators that are potentially dangerous living in amongst our settlements, you know, part of our cities or our villages.
No, we no longer have wombats the size of Volkswagens walking the land, do we? And although that'd be kind of cool if they still were.
It would be interesting, yeah. And in a way, the ocean is untamable territory. We also have a lot of fear of the unknown. So it makes sense that we're cautious and we're aware of predators and that we look out for ourselves. But I think there's also, a lot of sensationalism involved with shark attack, and particularly these days with media and movies and being able to play on these ideas, you know, for entertainment. I think it doesn't help to alleviate those fears or to combat those fears with, you know, good knowledge and understanding of what these animals are.
Great to speak with you, Chris, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Chris Dudgeon is a researcher in the Shark and Ray Laboratory at the University of Queensland's School of Biomedical Sciences.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.